So the word, the language of compassion, it's an interesting word for us, I think. Essentially, in the tradition, we understand it as that quality of heart that is moved to respond to suffering, to wish to bring it to an end, the quality of heart and mind that is concerned with and responsive to that which is difficult, that which is painful, that which is distressing. And it actually asks us to be willing to feel. It asks us to be willing to feel, to be close, to be sensitive to. It's not an easy thing to allow oneself to feel. I think we probably all know this. Because sometimes what we feel is not easy. Maybe that's a circular argument, but I think perhaps it's also just apparent without needing to be argued. So there's a question that really is in this for us all, I think. It's, you know, am I willing? Am I willing to let myself actually experience how it is for me to be exposed to that which is difficult, painful, scary, and distressing? Am I willing to let myself be impacted by that? There's a kind of a vulnerability that's required of us in this journey, that there's a willingness to be not just touched, but in being touched, we are affected, we are changed, actually. So far as we seek or wish to hold ourselves apart from that which is difficult, whether it's apart from those places in our own experience, our own life, our own body, heart and mind, or whether it's apart from others or apart from those things that we may see in the world that we might be sort of aware of, but we don't really let ourselves feel the impact of. We see that there's a challenge, there's a stretch that's called for in that willingness to let ourselves be affected. And it's easy for meditation practice to seem as it might be a way to not have to be affected, a way to make some space, make some distance, make some sort of quiet place in here that I can kind of hang out in and not be overwhelmed by or not be impacted by. And it's really important that we see, yes, there's a degree to which or way in which that's true, because so far as we're overwhelmed by or find ourselves sort of out of balance because of the degree and the intensity at times of that which is difficult, then finding some space, finding a place, some way in which we can settle and be simply present with our inner experience, not needing to try and resolve it or do anything with it, or even feel it more than it actually is, that actually gives some space and some relief. That first moment of, in a way, turning one's attention inwardly and seeing, oh, I don't have to pick up the things that are difficult. I have a choice. There's a training in that seeing we have a choice. So that we know then that when we do pick it up, that is also a choice. It's not being done to us. It's not being forced upon us. It's actually part of what we ultimately come not so much to seek for or to wish for, but to understand as something we willingly participate in, this and the engagement with that which is difficult. Understanding that that engagement offers its own fulfillment and its own transformation to us. And that we hold back from that at our peril, really, or peril is the wrong word, at our cost. And we probably all know and have seen the effect in ourselves of where we weren't willing to go to places that were difficult. And as a result, they tend to get more difficult. If we don't give attention to the things in this world that aren't well, they don't get better, or they don't become less well as a result of that inattention. It actually requires attention. And attention is the first step, really, in that process of compassionate responding that begins with a courage to feel, a courage to open, in the face of an uncontrollable, unpredictable, and at times exquisitely uncomfortable existence. Yeah? Of course, it can be lovely, delightful, sweet, and beautiful too. But we don't get the one without the other. And the cost of withdrawing from that which is difficult is actually more than the cost of being willing to meet it. Though there is a cost in meeting it. The cost of withdrawing from it, of disconnecting from it, is greater. And so, allowing ourselves to feel what it is that we feel in this world, allowing ourselves to be touched, and to see that naturally, of course, we wish for healing. We wish for the end of suffering. We wish for freedom from that which is distressing. We wish for the end of that which is distressing. And it's not given to us to make that happen. We can't necessarily bring it about. We can't necessarily make this body be free of pain. We can't make our communities be free of violence. We can't necessarily bring about, by some act of will or intention, the end of exploitation, of hunger, of loneliness in this world. And so there's something about making peace with the, in a way, the imperfectness of things. At in one of the meetings here with some of you earlier, someone was speaking about the distressing choice, and a very real, I thought, you know, very alive dilemma of fleas, and how, you know, we might say it's a small thing, but it's a really perfect example. One says, oh, yes, fleas. If I don't protect my cat from them, my cat suffers. And then this was this person speaking about their cat, but I have a cat, so I know this one. If I don't, then the cat suffers, and actually so do I eventually. It's not a mortal suffering, but it's not a lot of fun. And yet, to protect the cat from them involves the death of the fleas. There's so many situations like that, aren't there? I mean, that's just a small one in one sense, but you know, I went on to reflect, like, how do you make a choice like that? No matter which way you go, something's going to suffer here. And this is the nature of our lives and the nature of the world. There isn't an option that takes all of the suffering out. And, you know, I was kind of referring to it in the conversation. I remember having the experience when I was traveling in Asia as a young man of seeing so much hunger and poverty and need amongst the people, and feeling, couldn't I just give my relatively modest savings on which I was travelling to help some people here, for whom it would probably make a much bigger difference to their life than it was ever going to benefit mine? And to see, it was a very interesting encounter for me to realise, oh, I can't. Not that I can, obviously I could have, but something in me could not. Subjectively, I didn't have that capacity. And it's like, oh yeah, actually all of us, in a certain way, we've got a degree, me and you, a certain amount of what we can give or give up and what we just can't. Am I willing to live with fleas in order to not harm the fleas? And am I willing to impose that on my friends or my family or my pet animal? That choice, you know. Truth be for myself, no, I couldn't. I don't think I could. And I say that just because to see the dilemmas in the situation is to very much, I think, acknowledge the human limitations we work with, including our own. And it's actually often one of the first places the compassion needs to be found. It's for my own limitation and my ability to respond here. To be compassionate to myself for the fact that I can't just, you know, prioritize the well-being of others less fortunate to me than me until I'm that unfortunate, you know? It's an interesting, challenging thought. I have it sometimes. I play with it. I think, gosh, how much could I give away? But it always falls short of leaving me in the same degree of sort of, I could say, poverty as those who I might give it to. No? You know, we're so privileged here. We have so much. And it's not really helpful to give ourselves a hard time for our good fortune. Huh? But that's sometimes what it feels like. Why don't I do more? Why don't I do more? The truth is that it's because of our own vulnerabilities, our own fears, certainly for me, it's that. And it's also because there's something that's true about taking care of that which is closest to us. That's somehow where we have more responsibility. Now that we have to take care of this body, not disregarding all other bodies, but we do need to take care of this one if we have the capacity to do that. But at some level, it's not really possible to say that taking care of this person is more important than taking care of some other person. And yet that seems to be how it works. Does that make sense? I mean, it's like, at some level, it's irreconcilable, it's unsolvable, the reality that we will tend to look after ourselves. This is embarrassing. It doesn't sound very spiritual, but we will. It's what happens. I see it. And even, you know, I remember hearing about, you know, Ramana Maharshi, who in his apparently remarkable awakenings was so unperturbed by things that he would sit there while rats would chew on his buttocks and be not bothered. Now, it might seem like some remarkable, compassionate offering of one's body for the food of some creature, but there's also something that doesn't sound entirely compassionate towards one's body in that. Yeah, we've heard stories of, you know, apparently the Buddha once in one of his lifetimes, if one has a sense of such things, before he was awakened, he threw his body off a cliff to a mother tiger who was ill and injured, and her suckling cubs had not enough food. So some remarkable sacrifice. Like, wow, imagine someone doing that, you know? And it's true, that was really compassionate to the tiger and the cubs. It wasn't so compassionate to the person who, in that story, the Buddha was. And that was before he was enlightened. So it's not guaranteed that this was, you know, the ultimate expression of an enlightened being. I'm not saying it was a bad thing. There's a story I really love of a Zen poet and hermit monk, Ryokan, who I love very much. He's a remarkable character in the sort of the annals of Buddhist characters. And there's a story of once how on a winter's day, and he lived in a very simple hut and, you know, got his food through begging in the local villages. And there's a story on a winter's day when the sun had come out of him taking the lice out of his robe and putting them on a stone in the sun to warm themselves up, to sun themselves, you know. And this remarkable story of how tenderly he just would take the lice out of his coat, put them down there, and then at the end of the day, pick them up and put them back in his robe. And you think, wow, what was going on? You know, how remarkable, how beautiful to see what that being was expressing. Now, you know, I'm not saying that's something we have to sort of practice or aspire to, but I've played with such things. I've killed in my life any number of, it would be in the hundreds, if not thousands, of small creatures that were trying to bite me or eat me. You know, we've probably all done that, but I've spent a lot of time in the wilderness in New Zealand where there's a lot of those little things before I even thought about it. You know, and sometimes I find myself, it doesn't always happen this way, I'm not trying to make any great story out of this, but sometimes I feel moved to just see, okay, so what if we let them get one back on this and just see, and you know, it's actually not that bad to have a mosquito or, in New Zealand we have sand flies, like little black things that bite you. It's not that bad an experience, you know, if they're not carrying dengue fever or malaria or, you know, something dangerous like that. And it's interesting to see, oh, sometimes, you know, I haven't even noticed that I've done that. Sorry, this doesn't sound good, does it? Yeah, Buddhist teacher, gosh, first precept, blown it, you know? But that's the truth, isn't it? much as I would wish not to cause harm to any being, sometimes I do, just like that, and I haven't even thought of it. And sometimes I actually find arising in me the willingness, it lands and I think, oh, what's this? What's happening? And watch. And I've sometimes told the story of how one can re-see this in one's mind, because actually if it's a mosquito, it's always a female and it's always a mother. And in one sense, this is mother looking for food for her babies. That's what's happening. And then suddenly it feels, oh, yeah, I can let that happen. Not always. So where I find myself with this process is seeing what's possible here without having an idea. Sometimes it's a case of gently moving it on. Sometimes I'm distracted, I'm reactive, and it's gone before I even know what's happened. And if that's what happens, to stop and take a moment and feel the sorrow of it. Oh, it's not what I wish. I don't want to kill small creatures. I do. I do it every day, probably. Every time I get in a car, there's how many small creatures on the radiator grill at the end of the journey? Or a train, even. You know? How many small creatures on the windscreen of the train? Even public transport doesn't let you out of that particular responsibility. Yeah? It happens. But then to stop and let myself feel, oh, that's not what I wish. That's not my intention. And that informs the choices that I make and helps me remember sometimes when I might otherwise react. It's like, okay, what's possible here? What can I do here? And putting down the ideas that are very often driven by judgments or by other people's idea of what should happen or what I should do, to see what's possible for me. What can I contribute in a situation where there is this that is difficult? There is this that is distressing. There is this that is painful, sometimes excruciating. And whether we're talking about the excruciating pain that we might experience in our body, because bodies can feel incredible pain sometimes. A friend sprained her ankle a couple of days ago, and I went over to see her, having sprained my ankle quite a few times in my life. I had all the things you need for a sprained ankle, and it was just the amount of pain just in that, just after the injury, just so much pain. It's, in a sense, not a big thing, but so much pain our bodies can experience sometimes, just like that. Or to really sit and think about, to really let ourselves take on board what's happening in our world even today. So many good things, so many kind things, so many beautiful things happening, and so many tragic things happening. So much violence, exploitation, hunger, loneliness, greed. To really let that in. To really let ourselves feel and be touched by that. And then see, what can I do? What's the response of my heart here? What's possible? So, in terms of the Dharma teachings, compassion isn't just the feeling of concern or being touched. It is also the movement towards responding. They go together. They're not separate from each other. And that's really because when we let ourselves feel, there's always a response. Now, the response might just be in my heart or my thought that says, oh, may this person be safe. Or may this harm be healed. Or, you know, may my knee stop aching, you know. Or whatever it might be. It's, you know, classic meditators, you know, experience the aching knee. Certainly this meditator's experience. I don't know about what your might be, but I've heard enough of them over the years. But to just really let it in. Because when we let it in and let ourselves respond, what it does is it actually connects us with those things we care about. It connects us with those things we care about. And those connections are actually where the healing is. Not that healing means the difficult things go away or stop being there in the world or in ourselves, but that the connections that come from allowing ourselves to be open, to be vulnerable, to be touched, actually are speaking to us of our life and actually of our co-participation in the vastness, the wholeness, the fullness of life. And that's actually where the resolution, so far as there is resolution to suffering, to dukkha, actually comes to rest, comes to land. So far as we're not willing to feel and be touched by and respond, but to feel and be touched by, so long as we're not allowed, not willing to, we actually find that experience of what is difficult separates us. So far as we allow ourselves to be touched and to let the response come, which, whatever it might be, then rather than becoming separated in the process, we actually recognize more fully and deeply our connection. And it's often the case that there's a sense of, like, what can I do? I think one of the things we really need to look at and reflect upon is the way in which it's easy to feel some degree of hopelessness, helplessness, or even despair around the things we can't change, the things that we don't seem to be able to resolve or to fix. Again, in our own lives or in the vaster arena of the world. And it's easy to kind of withdraw from engagement and withdraw from letting ourselves really feel and know what's there because of the sense of despair or overwhelm that arises from not being able to resolve it. And again, someone touched on this in one of the conversations we were having just now around lunchtime, around the sense of pressure to have to fix it. When we can just stop, when we can just pause with the, this is how it is. And that might include, and it sucks. Now, this is how it is, and this is not as I wish it, or would wish it to be, on behalf of another, or myself, or, you know, some greater sphere. And in the pausing with that, and in the recognizing of that, and the seeing of that, see, well, what can be done here? What can be done? It's so important that we do what we can. We can't do more than that, but it's so important that we do what we can. And we don't measure the size of that or compare it to any idea or ideal or anyone else, in fact, and what they can or can't do. So, I had a dilemma a couple of days ago. I'd been planning to travel up to go to the climate march yesterday, and my friend injured herself, and I spent the afternoon with her. And at the end of it, I realized, having just got back from New Zealand, I wasn't ready to travel up that night and come to do that and then come to here. And I had to let go of getting to the march. And it was kind of like, I realized partly I was letting go of that I wanted to be there, partly I was letting go that I wanted other people to know that I'd been there, which was slightly less important really, but it had its own pull, and kind of humorous to say, oh, look, there's the me who wants to be there, wants to be seen to be there. And they're different. But the sense of, oh, this is what I could do right now. There was that immediacy, in one sense, small thing, a friend with an injury needs some help. Another sense, very big thing, planet getting cooked, needs some attention. Yeah. And yet in that situation, it just was like, okay, this is what I had to do. I don't know if that was the best choice or the right thing, but I couldn't do them both. That was the bit where I saw my own capacity limitation. If I try and do both of these things, then actually what happens today will be what bears the risk, will be affected. It's like I won't have the resources to give the time to this that I feel I need to. And so there's a situation with, and I mean, I'm just naming this as a simple thing that happened for me. I'm sure you all know these kind of situations. Do I look after these people or those people or this situation or that situation? And we can't do it all. So there's something for me in the practice of just opening up to as much of what I see and am aware of as I can and then seeing what comes and trusting it. Seeing, okay, I could say to my friend, sorry, you're on your own, kid. I'm really busy and I've got to go pretty soon. I could have. It would have been a fair enough response, but that wasn't what came. It was like, oh, no, right here, this person needs some help. I've got the time in this moment. Well, I've got the ability to choose to have that time. I'm not in a work situation that I can't say to my boss or whatever. And that's what happened. And so there's something about responding to the immediacy and trusting it that is, it's been really one of my, I think, biggest learnings and most, it feels like, important learnings in the realm of compassionate responses, just doing what I can and allowing that to be informed by expanding or developing or working on my capacity to just let as much of what's in need or that I could respond to come in. Knowing that half of what comes in, I'm not going to be able to do anything about. Not half, 95%. But just let it come and see then where my life goes. See where my life goes with that. And I wanted to share a story along those lines, which I've probably told here before, but I'm guessing not for a little while anyway. In the same times, and I don't know exactly when, but when I was traveling in Asia, when I talked about wanting to give my what I had away, which I couldn't, I had the opportunity one time when I was in Calcutta in India to visit the orphanage of the Order of Mother Teresa called Shishi Bhavan. Shishi is children, Bhavan is home, so children's home. And it was a place I was told before I went along with a friend that men weren't allowed to volunteer at because culturally men don't work with young children. In India, that's just the cultural not allowed. It doesn't happen. So, but we were told we could go and visit for a few hours. And I went along to this place. And now I'd been in Calcutta quite some time then. My grandmother is Bengali, so I have a sort of a... She was living there at the time. And so I have quite a feeling for this sort of the incredible beauty and tragedy of Calcutta, to be honest, and the wonder and the joy in people's faces, and equally the tragedy and the pain that is there. And so anyway, it's a long prelude. Sorry. Going to this home, we first of all met this group of young boys, and they were so uncle, 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 uncle. There's me and this other guy. I didn't know him that well, but we were probably in our early 20s. And these young boys, they didn't get to meet any men because men weren't allowed to work there. And not many went to visit, it seemed. So they were really excited just to meet some men. And uncle, uncle, you know, everyone's your relative in India once you've been introduced. And so uncle was the appropriate one. And it was just lovely. We hung out with these guys for a little while, these young chaps. But we'd actually also wanted to visit the younger beings there, because it was primarily an orphanage, but also for a lot of babies who either left there because their parents can't look after them and living in impoverished situations, or whose parents have actually died and they've been taken in because there's no real social services there in those terms. And so we went into this room. It was probably... I wonder if my memory distorts now over the years, but I think it was probably twice the size of the space. That's what I'm guessing. And it was full of cots, and the cots were packed together with just enough room between each cot for people to walk through. And there were two or three nuns, the sisters of the Order of Mother Teresa there. And in each of the cots, there were two beds. Sorry, two babies. Two pads and two babies in each of the little cots. And then there was these two or three nuns moving very purposefully, is the best way to describe it, amongst the cots. And they were feeding or they were cleaning the babies. That's what it was. It was a bottle or a cloth in their hand. And it was either getting business at one end or the other. You know, that was what was going on. And as we walked into the room, me and this guy, these babies looked up at us. And some of them started to reach their arms up, and others started to try and pull themselves up on their little cots. And we looked at each other, and we both knew intuitively, it seemed, exactly what the situation was. There was dozens and dozens of babies here and just a few nuns who had just enough time to feed them and to clean them. And they didn't have time to pick them up and hold them. They just didn't. And these little babies wanted to be held. Babies, that's what they want. And they knew they wanted it, and they recognized us somehow. They'd never seen us before, but they recognized human beings. And so there's this room full of babies. And we so pick up a baby, and it was like a limpet, or a, you know, just sort of they're just sucking up, just oh, and just holding these little beings just for a while. Just, and then after a while, because there's a room full of these little beings, you're just peeling this one off, putting it down, picking up another one. And it was a really amazing and powerful experience for me. It was heartbreaking that we were only allowed to stay for a couple of hours, and that we didn't even get around to all the babies in the room, and that any one of them I could have spent those 2 hours with. But I couldn't, because there was all these babies. And there was some part of me that was, as this was going on, saying, you know, you could spend the rest of your life in this room doing this, and I can't imagine a better or more meaningful life than that. You know, just doing that. And after a certain time, they said, that's your 2 hours or three, I don't remember now. You know, Jello, which means, you know, you have to go now. And we live. And there's something that I still have, this very felt sense of just having done what we could. We didn't save those babies. We didn't give them that much, I guess, you know, a few minutes each for most of them, and a few, no minutes at all for a few of them. But there's something about that sense of just having opened up to the immensity of need, the insufficiency of capacity, and said, okay, this is what's possible here. That felt both heartbreaking but also healing. And it remains as a kind of a marker for me of, okay, this is actually what makes sense. Or this is how to try and respond in a world where there is so much at times suffering. With it in my own personal experience of just, what can I do for the places in me that hurt? Or in the world with so much that's needed. There's so much that's needed. And so it's really clear to me that it does not matter in the end what the outcome of the action is in terms of how far we get down the track of resolving. But what is crucial is that that is the direction one moves in and does what one can, or moves so far in that direction as is possible. There are so many things that are worthy of our care, of our time, of our efforts and endeavours. The liberation of one human heart is a worthy thing. If that's what moves us above all, to just understand and free our own lives more deeply and fully, that's a beautiful thing to offer to this world. And equally, the caring for, the healing, the helping, the serving and the supporting of those in need, in trouble, in difficulty, in strife or stress, whether in our homes, our families, our communities, or beyond them in the world. Allowing ourselves, this is what it seems to me, allowing ourselves to live the caring that lives within us. To see that when we do, when we act in a way that comes from a rejection of the difficulty, of the suffering, of the distress, of the, at times, inhumanity we might see around us in human beings. When we reject or judge that, it doesn't serve the process. When we open our heart to it, and that's part of what's painful, is seeing that, oh my gosh, it's human beings much of the time causing more harm than anything else. these supposedly intelligent, sensitive, wonderful, precious beings, who at the same time are so often, and I don't exclude myself, caught or lost in some pattern of blindness or reactivity. That we really wish to address that, that we really wish to find a way for that to be different. And sometimes that involves standing up and saying no to that which is not okay. This is the reference to the march in Selma, or the march from Selma, in fact, that gives the title to the film. People standing up and saying no. Oppression, discrimination, it's not okay. People yesterday walking on the streets of London saying with regard to what's happening in the ecology of our planet, saying no, this has to change. And that the vested interests that are benefiting from that destruction have to be challenged. And sometimes that's not always done politely. That's sometimes how it has to be. I've reflected quite a lot in recent years on the images one finds outside of temples and monasteries in Asia, where this tradition comes from, where we often associate sort of meditation and Buddhist practice with sort of a gentle sensitivity and kindliness and friendliness and never being particularly fierce. And yet if you look on the entrances to most temples and monasteries in Asia, you find these very fierce, sort of demonic, gargoyle-like characters, you know, and they're not the sort of character you want to meet in a dark alley of a night, you know? And sort of reflecting on, so what are they representing? It's like there's a fierceness that's also called forth from us, to be fierce in our courageous standing up for what we believe in and confronting that which is needing to be confronted. It requires a real courage in ourselves to not reject the patterns in us that are leading or causing suffering, the habits, the tendencies, the reactivities. As we spoke about earlier, the tendency to be hard on ourselves that we learnt from someone who learned it from someone. Not to reject it, but to stand up and say, no, that's not helpful. Stop. To that place in ourselves that keeps thinking it's a good idea to give me a hard time. It's not helpful. Standing up in the world and saying, in the face of that which is not okay, no, this is not acceptable. That inner and outer courageous standing up and naming what's true, what we see, doesn't mean that it stops, but it means that we locate ourselves clearly in relationship to it, in a way in which we're not giving it support, and which, in such way as we can do, we're perhaps giving support to that which counterbalances it. And it's so important that we do this with each other. I mean, not to each other, but in terms of that one speaks with and shares with other people what it is that we're concerned about, what it is that we care about, what it is that we're, you know, just respect. Not in the, you know, the staff room sort of having a go at whoever we don't like sort of version of sharing what we're concerned about, but more like, wow, I feel this deeply, or this saddens me, rather than that person shouldn't, and that one, da-da-da-da-da. Which actually tends to become more of the same problem, because it just generates aversion and aggression, rather than something more courageous, something more willing to be vulnerable at the same time as fierce. So, compassionate response doesn't look like something particular. It may look sweet and soft and tender and gentle, and it may be sometimes. And it may sometimes be fierce or even provocative. But where one is on the inside, in terms of actually being touched by and listening for what seems like authentic response, what seems like true response, and what gives it the most possibility of being that seems to me, and from my experience, seems to be being as open as I can to as much as I can be. Listening also to my places of limitation, of vulnerability or reactivity. Hearing that they're telling me, not that I should or I shouldn't do something, but that, yeah, okay, you too are a limited being in one sense. You too have your own places you have to take care of. You don't have to impose some idea upon yourself, in this case myself, of how I should be, but to see what's possible for me here. Can I, in this situation, rise beyond that? Or, if I can't, can I take care of whatever it is that limits me? So that the inner and the outer work really go together. And working on our hearts and our minds and meditation, it's not just so that they're a more comfortable place to hang out, but because in doing that, that actually frees up our capacity to respond, to be in the world in a way that makes a difference to it. And a little bit like when I spoke about that experience for me at Shishu Bhavan, the children's home in Calcutta, there's something about, as one opens more and more fully, the heart both breaks and is healed in the response. That the opening stretches us perhaps beyond what we can imagine to really let in how it is to be in this world. But in that stretching, in that opening, allowing the response of our innate caring that is fundamental to what we are. And something that cannot be lost, although can be buried somewhat deeply at times. To allow that to find its expression, to let that speak to us, because this is actually where the deepest satisfaction comes. This is where the deepest meaning, happiness comes. Not according to whether my life is comfortable or easy, much as I wish that it would be. But to what extent we can allow that process to happen. To allow ourselves to be touched and to respond. To act out of that care for all beings, for all of life. And at the same time to make space for the ways in which we will not be able to do so. To include that within that field of compassionate acknowledgement. So I think I'll pause there.